Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the 343 Sparkcast. We have a special one here for you. It's more special, even more special than special. I'm going to say special 18 times in the first 20 seconds. What are we up to? Eight? No, I'm not. I'm David Ellis. I'm a designer here at 343.
And you're special?
Apparently. Oh, we got someone vacuuming outside. You probably can
every
hear that.
Time. I swear to God, it's like a podcast detection cleaner.
It adds to the ambiance. It makes people feel like they're actually here.
What time? Like we record these things hours apart. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter
time.
Any day of the week. Boom. Yep. Boom.
So that's two voices you've heard so far. To my left, working my way around, is Josh Holmes, our studio creative director here at 343. Welcome back. And Frank O'Connor, franchise development director here at 343.
Up.
He's rocking a laptop and a cell phone today, so he's
charging
really
my cell
engaged
phone.
In the
I'm
conversation.
Charging my cell phone, and I'm updating it, and if I don't, I'll get in trouble.
He's got like an industrial-sized crane attached.
I'm just saying, you're in Keeley territory of double-fisting right now. With
it's not a BlackBerry. Hey, did you know that BlackBerry can receive emails? Isn't that amazing?
I've heard that.
It's crazy.
And on my right are the Chris's, as I'll refer to them only this one time. Chris Blum,
Hello.
Systems designer here, working on Halo 4 at 343.
Hello.
And Chris King, who is the lead sandbox designer, lead combat designer, lead sandbox designer.
Lead sandbox.
There we go.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
Sandbox stuff.
And based on that, you can probably figure out what we're talking today, and that's sandbox. In case if you're curious what sandbox means, it means every weapon, every grenade, almost every vehicle, every armor mod, and every armor ability. We just wanted to talk about the weapon sandbox, combat sandbox in Halo 4, talk about the concepts that we're introducing for the first time in a Halo, talk about some stuff we're bringing back, and talk about how we're balancing all together into this package we call Halo.
I think we should start with the Mantis, really. Like, we should just start talking about the giant mech that we call the Mantis and how awesome it is.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I agree.
Yeah.
So anyway,
good.
I wanted to start out with armor abilities because that's something that we decided to bring over from Halo Reach. It was introduced in Halo Reach as part of the combat sandbox. We've obviously made a lot
armor
of changes.
Abilities. Yep,
we've made a lot of changes. They were sort of an evolution of the
power-ups.
Equipment and power ups that had been a staple of Halo since Halo 1. Of course, equipment was really introduced in Halo 3, which were these deployable items that gave you extra abilities and stuff.
Yeah.
So
they're all kind of the root is obviously the power ups from Halo 1.
Yeah,
like it's a sort of natural evolution of that.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah,
but so one of the questions I think is some people would want to ask, and some purists perhaps, was why we actually decided to bring armor abilities back. I mean, Halo Reach was a prequel, and there was a fictional wrapper for why they were there, but Halo 4 is obviously a sequel to the main series in Halo 1, 2, and 3, and we pick up 5 years after Halo 3. Why did we decide to kind of reintroduce, in some ways, the armor abilities back into the combat sandbox?
So we talked about this last year at Halo Fest, and
it's a fight. We're going to beat
the
vacuum.
We're going to beat the vacuum. And I mean, you know, armor abilities are that evolution of equipment. And what I think works about the concept is that it's replenishable equipment. It becomes part of the natural combat loop, something that you can reuse. And so, like, at its core, I think that it works within the Halo sandbox. It comes down to how you execute against that.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, I think one of the questions that I think a lot of people have had is, how did we decide on what we were going to keep and bring over from Halo Reach and what we were going to introduce? Obviously, there's a lot of new armor abilities we're introducing in Halo 4. And how did we kind of... Did you sit down with like a sheet of paper and like look at what was there, what you thought was fun, how you could change it, balance it, rebalance it, and what you thought that was missing that we could introduce in Halo 4 as it relates to armor abilities?
Yeah, so to add on to what Josh was saying, I think the other thing that really resonated with us about the armor abilities is that it's a way for us to cater to different play styles. So if you strictly base the sandbox on, say, weapons, right? A lot of the thing that drives how players play and essentially who plays the game down the line becomes skill and tactical knowledge of the game, right? And so armor abilities allowed us to sort of leverage ways to provide players that, say, may not be good at combat, that may want to support teammates or they may want to defend the base or do these other things. It allowed us a way to give them a role in the sandbox.
And I'll add on to that, actually, also with AAs, I mean, it's this sci-fi dream, this armor and this warrior, this Spartan IV that's inside the armor. And the AAs allow us a allow that person to do something on the battlefield that's interesting. So when we look at the Reach AAs, I mean, we brought 3+1 forward. We brought Jetpack Hologram Camouflage and Thruster Pack, which is a bit like Evade.
Except for unlike Evade, it doesn't actually shrink down your hitbox. And it's actually designed around Spartans. I mean,
plus,
I think
it's awesomer.
It's awesomer.
I think a lot of people remember that Evade was originally introduced as an armor ability for elites.
Elites, yeah.
Of course, Bungie designed it so you could use it for both, but it was originally intended for elites and then added into matchmaking for Spartans.
Absolutely. And, you know, just a segue for a second on Thruster Pack, we also kind of tuned how you use it and when you want to use it. It's a tactical decision that you can use probably once per encounter. So you have to choose, do you want to open with it? Do you want to get out of jail with it? Do you want to thrust around the corner after you kill someone? They're all interesting choices, and I think that's important.
I actually totally agree with you, and I think we can actually go back to originally the Thruster Pack, and we can talk about this because it actually changed. It's part of the iterative process, the design. The Thruster Pack at one point was actually a teleport.
Yeah, it was actually a Promethean ability, the ability of teleport or phasing, and we had it working for quite a while, and it felt awesome. But it was
really overpowered.
Yeah, that was a problem. Of course it felt awesome because you were just destroying people with it left and right. You'd get a shotgun and you'd teleport and you'd wrecking shop over people, and people are like, oh god, no, I never want to play with them ever again. And so yeah, clearly that didn't work, but that was kind of the kernel of it.
And I think when we showed it off for the first time at E3, it was actually interesting because we actually got the effects hooked up to it, the kind of sparks that shoot out of the thruster pack as you're using it. And for me personally, that was actually a big moment when we added that, because even before, it was still – I felt like it was a little too powerful because it was difficult to track. Now that you have this like huge visuals trail of sparks, it's literally falling behind you.
I mean, the flip side of it being difficult to track for your target is it's difficult for you to sort of calculate exactly where you're going to end up.
Well, we changed something important there.
Yeah,
it has predictable behavior, and if you're paying attention, you know exactly where you're going to end up when you thrust.
Yeah.
But you do effectively lose control. You lose some lateral or vertical movement depending on which way you boost.
Yeah. And you're locked into it.
And you're stuck. Yeah, you've made a decision, and
that's,
if the guy...
That's Chris actually makes an important point.
Yes, yeah. You put your gun down for... Yep.
So there was a period of time that I used to great advantage for personal hubris and wealth and killing other people and making fun of them.
Yep.
You could actually shoot while you were thruster packing, and it still was a little too powerful.
It was a little bit too powerful. So, you know, that's a great example, though. I mean, we took all these AAs and we played with them. We made sure they fit into our sandbox. Mm-hmm. We played with them a lot. And Thruster Pack went from teleport to your gun being up and you sliding 30 meters across the ground to what it is now, which is a very tactical usage.
And I think Jetpack changed actually quite a bit from Halo Reach to Halo 4. It was one of those armor abilities that doesn't matter who you are. If you're using it, it's just a blast to use.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but if you're on the other end of it, it can be really frustrating to fight against.
Chris might hate me for saying this, but Jetpack has been significantly nerfed in terms of what you can do with it in terms of how you sort of vertically place yourself.
I absolutely agree.
Because of that, it has that lip. There's probably a better way to describe what I'm talking about, but there's a limit to what you can do and how much you can control your sort of your vertical.
Absolutely.
Hover.
We went after Jetpack in a number of different ways. I think, you know, first of all, the map design guys, the environment guys looked at Jetpack and thought about it while they were making their maps. Mm-hmm. And then our ecosystem is totally different. Guys go onto the battlefield with a DMR, so Jetpack's different because you're up in the air. You know,
you can't hang out in the air the amount you can. So that's actually something important just at the top that we should talk about, is that you thrust up, but you can't hold up at the top nearly as much as you could in Halo.
Absolutely.
Reach.
We tuned it. There's a number of different things we could have done to Jetpack, and there's a number of things we did do to Jetpack. We looked at the energy. We looked at the lift off the ground. We looked at the ability to catch yourself and the ability to hover. And to use Frank's term, we nerfed a lot of those.
The thing that I think is like the best tell of balance across the armor abilities, and when you know something's broken, is like you go into playtest and when everybody's taking thrusters, like you're like, okay, I think thrusters might be a little overpowered. Yeah. When everyone's taking jetpack, same thing. Mm-hmm. And now you guys have got it to a place where you go into playtest and everyone's got their own individual
strategy and their play style, and it all feels like it works. It just works in different ways.
And it's not always about nerfing. Sometimes it's actually about improving something, actually Absolutely. Bringing it up to the level of everything else that's there.
Yeah, and I think actually to go back to the jetpack idea, I mean, jetpack still is that fundamental dream of, you know, an armored suit that flies through the air. We just looked at it a little bit. And, you know, to go to what Josh just said, yeah, I mean, everybody uses different AAs to enhance how they personally play, which is great. That's where we want it. We don't want it to dominate the sandbox. We want it to be part of the sandbox, part of a tool that you use.
So there's a couple of other armor abilities that we haven't really talked about too much that people have kind of heard about in dark corners of the internet where people leak things.
Well, before you do that,
yeah.
I want to touch on the last one that was brought over, because what you said was, you know, there have been some things that have been brought up. And I think that that hologram is one that actually you guys have improved.
Totally. Actually, because one of the things in Halo Reach, there was sort of a bug with hologram where sometimes when you – I can't remember exactly how it worked, actually. I got to be honest. But sometimes when you shoot it out, it would show up as like a regular part of the radar. And other times it would show up as being like – it wouldn't show up correctly on the radar, perhaps. I might edit that out. I can't remember exactly how that worked.
But, so you edited it out to make you look smart.
What have you,
that's kind of the point.
Why can't you do that?
Actually, I do that for everyone.
Oh, good. It doesn't work.
Some people don't require it.
Oh, wow.
Is it working? Does he believe it? Does he buy it?
No. I think not for a second.
But like one of the things that's important with hologram is like it looks like an enemy combatant. And now actually every time you shoot it out, it actually shows up as an enemy combatant in the radar.
Yeah, what are the things that you guys have changed?
Okay, so it's on your radar as a enemy combatant. Your reticle will go red when you're looking at it. There's a couple of tells. If you shoot it, it's going to
kind of flicker.
It's going to go like it's active camouflage. It's gonna alpha out. You're going to notice right away.
But your reticle's still red when it's over.
Your reticle is still red. So you can use it more effectively as a decoy, right? So we talk about armor ability kind of verbs and holograms decoy, right?
Yeah.
So it works as a decoy. The things that it does that, you know, is a weakness, everything has a weakness, every armor ability has a weakness. Holograms run straight. Holograms don't shoot.
That's if a guy what is running down cannons the hallway were invented for. Man cannons are a hologram's best friend.
What's that?
Man cannons are a hologram's best friend.
Yeah, they're pretty awesome with them. Like, where'd this guy come from? So, everything has a weakness. So he does run straight. He doesn't shoot, but he looks like an enemy. If you do shoot him, he's going to flicker out. You're going to see that. You're going to have to react. The problem is the guy that, you know, is decoying you is going to use that one shot to his advantage.
One of my favorite techniques to use with hologram, there are actually two of them in Halo Reach that I've actually still been able to use pretty effectively, is if I have like a plasma sword or a rocket launcher, I will have it out when I shoot the hologram and then switch weapons, because inevitably someone is going to be tracking on someone that has that power weapon before they track on me, and because it just works that way. And the other one was actually really fun, is if you catch someone looking at you while you shoot the hologram, is looking straight down and just follow the shoot the hologram right at your feet and then just run forward and see if you can trick them into actually tracking the thing that's standing still.
So this
and
happens,
making you assume that you're
absolutely
a hologram.
Absolutely happens. Just the other day, you know, you're looking at your radar, you see one blip on the radar, then you see two blips. One of them is a hologram. Guy runs straight down the hallway, that's the hologram. The guy turns and shoots you with a shotgun. It happens. Absolutely.
So we're introducing some new armor abilities, of course, in Halo 4. And I want to talk a little bit about a couple of those. And there are some of them that you may be hearing about for the first time. Some of you may have heard about them in other outlets before. One of them in particular that I think people will recognize in a manner of speaking from Halo 3 and Halo 4, and that's the regen field. Can you guys talk a little bit about what your thinking was in introducing the regeneration field within Halo 4 and what you feel like it brings to the combat sandbox?
Sure. So it does – I mean it has all sorts of kind of influences. You see things in Reach that would heal you or, you know, throw out a bubble of sorts. But mostly, you know, think about Halo 3 and the regenerator.
Yeah.
It's like that. So
does the field that you send around, does it actually – can you shoot through it? Can you throw grenades?
You can shoot through it. It's green like the Halo regenerator, but you can shoot through it. It does not deflect projectiles. It does not hold people out of it. Anybody inside of it to about 10 feet heal. They heal at a reduced rate, but they automatically start to heal when they're inside the field. I will say right now that it's not as effective as the Halo 3 regenerator.
And that's by design, actually.
Absolutely. A guy with a DMR comes around the corner and, you know, Chris comes around the corner and I'm standing in a regen field. We both have DMRs. If he lands every shot with a DMR, I will die, just like I was outside of the field. If he misses a shot, I might start to regenerate a little bit. So it's going to require an extra bullet.
And I think one of the important things that were balanced for a long time with regen field, Chris, is actually you actually have to sort of charge it up before you can unleash the regen field. Can you talk a little bit about what the timing was on balancing that? Because you actually need to expose. I felt like you guys felt like you needed to expose the player a little bit before you could use it. So you can't just drop it right in the middle of a firefight and actually expect to survive it.
Yeah, I mean, we've tuned this thing a couple different ways. Initially, when we started out off with it, we made it so that players had, I don't know, a 0.75, 1 second delay before they could deploy it. And that was because in encounters, we found that people weren't really using it how we intended. Originally, this armor ability was really about supporting your teammates. And what happened was we found that players were instantly deploying it in the heat of combat, and they could counter a guy and beat him. So we had slowed it down, and then as we slowed it down, it just started feeling so terrible that no one ended up using it, and you couldn't use it effectively with teammates. The pace of the game was so fast that people wouldn't wait for you to deploy it and run over and run into it. So we found sort of this happy medium where you deploy it fast, but you can't use it in the heat of combat, right? What's the timing you've got on it now, Chris?
I think it's about just under half a second.
Yeah, so it's like half a second. So that was kind of the sweet spot where you use it more as a support armor ability. It's not like this parry in the middle of combat
yeah.
where you instantly regen your energy shield.
What I think is really interesting, and something we talked about before, is that this entire like combat sandbox carries over, of course, between the main campaign and war games, but also carries over into Spartan Ops. And I actually find myself personally, there are certain armor abilities that I feel like in some cases are more useful in Spartan Ops versus war games, and of course vice versa. And I think regeneration field is one of those for myself. I'll use it in certain game modes and war games, certainly. I think especially big team battle, big team situations where you can be more a support player, super useful. But in Spartan Ops, I find it incredibly useful. And I think one of the other armor abilities that I actually use that I find very useful in Spartan Ops is the auto sentry turret. And that's something that's actually was introduced in the Halo 3 campaign. And we're sort of bringing it back in some ways, but also changing it and tweaking it as it's a Promethean ability this time around. I think there are a lot of people when they hear the idea of an auto turret being introduced into their battlefield where they're one person versus one other person. I don't want anyone else getting involved. It's my shot versus their shot. They might be a little turned off, at least at the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about what the auto turret is and what do you think it presents into the battlefield?
Well, it's important to note that it's called the auto sentry.
I'm using the old term.
No, I wasn't calling you out.
I apologize.
Well, it used to be called the personal auto turret.
Yes.
The pat. Infuriates me. It's the auto sentry. So in war games and in Spartan Ops, it does a couple of things. But one of the first things you'll notice when you deploy it, it makes a noise and it points at an enemy. So it's extremely useful in objective games.
And it's fair to point out that originally it actually followed you around when you were the player.
Yeah,
it's very similar to the Halo 3 kind of personal turret.
I don't know if we want to talk about all the things it used to do.
I think that's okay to talk about.
It used to do a lot of things.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And it the balance went from – I remember the engineer who first coded it.
You mean Joe Waters?
Joe Waters. He coded it, and he was like – he coded it so it was so – fucking dominant.
I may have thrown a controller at Joe Waters.
Oh yeah,
first time
it was like
this.
If you just it was the auto win armor ability. Like just deploy this and everybody dies. And then as soon as we were like, okay, well we need to pull this back, Joe's like, what? Why are you making it so uncool? What's wrong with this? And yeah. But it had to happen.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it was used to be like an active thing that would follow you, like we mentioned. But now it's when you actually release the auto sentry, I gotta catch myself. It actually stays in place and it sort of pivots back and forth.
It pivots back and forth. It's got about 180 degrees that it'll watch. So people use it in a number of different ways. They'll try to lure people towards it, or when they're camping, or they'll put it at their back if they're a sniper because they'll hear it chirp. Hmm. The important thing to note is as soon as it sees an enemy, everybody sees it on its radar, on their radar, on their motion tracker. So it's not like it's this invisible, small little thing that'll snipe you. It makes a noise. It makes a flash. Everybody knows it's there. And then it starts to fire at the player. Now, it's this little floaty kind of auto turret, so it's not extremely deadly. It shoots at you, but, you know.
It's more just to catch your attention rather than actually kill you. Although it will if you're not paying attention.
It will if you stay put. What you need to do is you need to move. You need to move. If it knows where you are, it's going to shoot you, and it's going to kill you. So just move. The other thing is that buys time for the other player, the player that's using their armor ability slot for this sentry. It buys them time to try to pin you down and kill you, though, you know, like, you know, Frank said before, I believe, it's an opportunity cost. So you have something to counter the auto sentry. So we should also say that when we talk about armor abilities, they all have some sort of weakness, either with another armor ability or in the sandbox someplace. And sentries almost, I'll scratch that. Sentries always fall for holograms. Absolutely. So if a team is camping out and they got a sentry looking both ways, you send a hologram in, both sentries will snap to the hologram, hopefully drawing the gaze of the two players, and then, you know, you can run in and do your business on a level play.
And I'll say for myself in Spartan Ops, the holograms...
You got to do your business.
Do your business. Yeah.
Both the hologram, and, because for a while there, the hologram, the AI, the enemy AI, didn't necessarily pay attention to it, but it's recently been tweaked a little bit that in Spartan Ops, hologram's super useful, auto turret... What I love to do is be in a situation where the enemy is just on the other side of cover, and I'll jump up and release the auto sentry, and it'll start shooting. I finally got it right.
Well, you guys are talking about, so there's a couple of things. One is that when you launch an auto sentry, you're exposed again, you sort of like pull back and you do this little cool animation, but you're exposed during that point, and it also tells people who are launching the auto sentry.
Yeah.
And the other thing is you're talking about in a multiplayer context. The fact is in single player or Spartan Ops, it's actually – I find it even more useful because like anyone can just run out of the way. This sort of – it's, you know, the way it shoots you in multiplayer, it's an irritant. Yeah. But in single player, in campaign and in Spartan Ops, it will definitely either finish off badly damaged knights,
yep,
or straight up kill lone crawlers.
And there's some very
it's not very good with packs of crawlers, but it'll take out lone crawlers.
There's some very specific moments in the campaign in particular where you should pick it up if you get the option.
It distracts them, it's a huge distraction because they come out and you're using their technology against them. It has the best point of view in the game. And so they're pretty smart. They'll turn and look at what is the thing that has the best vantage point in this battle, and they'll pick the auto sentry, even though it's weaker because it has a better point of view. And they're like, everyone can see it, and you'll sometimes find like two knights and all the crawlers suddenly turn their attention.
Yeah, my favorite thing is to like find
better
a piece
than a hologram
of cover.
Sometimes
find a piece of cover, deploy it so that it just peeks over the cover, and then use that to run around the cover and flank.
Well, I had to do a demo of M30, I think, and I didn't have hologram, and I wanted to show off assassinations. So I was able to distract knights with the auto sentry to do assassinations, right?
It didn't work as well because
are you talking about sort of gauging danger.
Well, we can say this. You're talking about the forts area?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, any area. I was doing pretty badly, so I was doing it when there was like one knight. When you get to the fort, it's much easier to distract them than it is to use it to kill them, right? Because it's not going to kill anybody.
Stop giving away our secret code names.
Yeah, I know. but it was just like it's a really good – it's weak in a lot of ways if you think about it, but it's an incredibly powerful tool.
It's also very useful in objective game types and war games. You can have a couple of teammates that are just specializing in defense, and they can use that as a force multiplier.
Absolutely. So they have to watch out for holograms, but frag grenades, anything – you can kill these things relatively easily. Though on defense – one of the tricks we just saw, if we want to talk about maybe a little bit of a pro tip, is let's say Josh and I are defending a flag, which never happens because Josh is in a ghost running people over. So if we both had the auto sentry and we're on defense, the best thing to do is actually place it in the other person's position, and he places his in my position, because when, David, you run around the corner and you see the sentry and you see me, you're going to try to kill me because you're, you know.
Yeah.
When we get in a DMR fight, David Ellis wins.
I'd like to think so.
Yes. Yeah. So you're going to ignore the auto sentry. So you're going to kill me while the auto sentry is hitting you, thinking that the auto sentry is going to be derezzed when I die, but it's actually Josh's. So if I can hold my own long enough, the auto sentry might deliver that just the one blow, the killing blow that's needed. And then Josh is laughing on the other side of the flag because he just sees.
And that's actually an important point you just made.
Idea. Yeah, it's absolutely.
So when you unleash your auto sentry, when you die, it gets taken out.
It gets removed, yes.
You can't just leave it there forever.
I think one of my favorite things about the auto sentry is when you're using Armor Lock 2 and the bullets ricochet off of Armor Lock 2 and kill everyone on the whole battlefield. That's the best.
That. I'm curious what you mean by that turn of phrase, Frank.
Well, that's the elephant in the room. We took out Armor Lock because we didn't like it.
But one thing we did introduce is the hard light shield.
Yes, but it doesn't stop or slow combat.
Exactly.
I think nobody who complains about Armor Lock ever complains about anything except the pause button, right?
Yeah.
Armor Lock changes the pace of the combat, not just for the two combatants who are actually encountering it, but for everyone. Like you're on sword base, you see Armor Lock in a bridge, you just go away. You're just like, I'm coming back here later.
The other issue that I have with Armor Lock is that it's not enough of a trade-off. You're not giving enough up. Sure, you have to remain stationary, but you're invincible.
And you're on equal ground when you come out of it.
And you heal.
And there's an EMP, and you can rotate.
Exactly. You can also rotate your camera.
Let's all agree. When used correctly, Armor Lock is very fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the people who are angry, like Kevin Grace, about removing Armor Lock, it's because that was giving him a significant leg up in the fight.
Yes. And we've all encountered entire teams of Armor Lockers, and they're going to be pissed. And it was, and part of the reason they're going to be upset is because Armor Lock was actually really fun to use if you liked it. It just people who don't like it don't find it fun to fight against.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be clear. I use Armor Lock an awful lot. I do. I like using it.
And you also cook and eat kittens.
That's the kind of person that you are.
You're like
So I think the next element of the kind of combat sandbox that we want to talk about tonight are, of course, the weapons. First-person shooter wouldn't be anything without what you can shoot. Weapons are those things that you shoot. And Halo 4, we actually introduced a bunch of new elements, reintroduced some old elements that had been missing for a couple of games. And so, Chris King, as we've sort of talked about these weapons a little bit more than the others, the UNSC weapons. And obviously, chief among them, it holds a special place in a lot of Halo fans' hearts. The reintroduction of the battle rifle for the first time since Halo 3. That's a big responsibility to kind of bring that back. People have very strong opinions on the Halo 2 battle rifle versus the Halo 3 battle rifle.
Right.
And, of course, now we have the Halo 4 battle rifle. People have a lot of opinions about that. So what was your thought process on bringing this weapon back?
Well, I think one of the interesting things to talk about of the development process of Halo 4 is that this was sort of a controversial thing when we started, right? We wanted to bring both the DMR and the BR back, and you have super hardcore Halo fans working here, right? And there was some apprehension because traditionally Halo had focused on just having one of these weapon roles per faction. And so the notion of even bringing back both the DMR and the BR in conjunction caused a lot of conflict on the team because we discussed what does it mean to have two different weapons that sort of share the similar role. And that sort of opened the floodgates for other things too, right? Then we started talking about the notion of, oh, what if we had three mid-range weapons? What if we had four mid-range weapons? So it's sort of interesting because in isolation, right, you talk to Halo fans and you run into some guys who are hardcore devoted BR guys. And then you'll run into other guys who swear by the Halo Reach DMR. They just love the sound effect, the cadence, all that stuff.
The satisfaction of getting that last single shot on a head.
Yeah, absolutely.
And taking an enemy out.
Absolutely. And so this very minor design decision by sort of our perspective sort of opened the floodgate to, are we drastically changing the Halo sandbox? Are we introducing too much player choice to the players? Will people be able to understand if we go down this route of having multiple weapons that sort of overlap in roles and functionality? And it's sort of interesting because we sort of went down that path, but at this point, everyone loves it. Like, I went to a playtest this week with MLG guys, and you saw almost 50-50 split with DMR BRs, right?
It's an interesting thing. In certain scenarios, the DMR is definitely far and away better than the BR, especially at the extreme ranges of the combat. but there is something inherently satisfying about that, for me personally, that triple bullet, one trigger pull, three bullet burst out of the BR that just feels right.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is something that I'm like sitting here smiling and laughing because like I was right at the center of this stuff because I was pushing very strongly for increased player choice to a point where I know people on the team got really uncomfortable. But I think it's as simple as in some cases in Reach, you get into a battle and everyone's got DMRs and you just have the exact same like sound and the exact same interaction over and over and over. And it just gets exhausting.
And that's fine for a certain segment of the audience that would love to just use one weapon for the rest of their life and just specialize into that.
They can, let's be clear.
Yeah, they absolutely can.
To do that.
But,
yeah.
But by allowing people like these two different choices, you get you just mix things up and it makes the whole experience
I don't think it's either or. Like there's plenty of circumstances where weirdly having both, it totally works. Like there's you have the firepower package where you can carry two rifles, right?
Right.
And so we were playing SWAT and I loaded up BR and DMR and we were playing it on a large level with a Vic De Leon level.
Yes. I know this level particularly.
Guess why SWAT works great with two completely different rifles on that level. Right. So if you're at the bases on that level,
yep.
You switch to BR because you could come around a corner and BR is going to be better.
And that level in particular.
If you're shooting over hills, then you want the DMR.
Exactly.
And it totally makes sense. And the same goes for Spartan Ops. Like even the demo mission that Cauldron. So,
yeah.
We've shown off the Spartan Ops mission Cauldron. I use BR and DMR because I'll use the DMR to take out Watchers and Knights. And I'll use the BR to take out Crawlers. And it makes perfect sense, right? And you're like, okay, that's a quick loadout, those two rifles.
So that's actually something important to point out. One of my fellow Spartan Ops designers used to accuse me of stealing kills.
because probably you steal kills.
Because I used the BR against the crawlers for that specific reason, because you can be a little less accurate with it and still get that single shot on the head that's going to cause them to pop like bubble wrap or popcorn or whatever. And that's
so
how they're designed.
We can come back like... One of the best moments of Spartan Ops is when you and three of your friends are sitting there and you're looking at each other. You just spawn in and you look to your left and you look to your right and you're like, really? You know, AR, he's got an AR, he's got whatever. And you just, but you, as a team, you know exactly, you know, Frank's got the BR DMR combo. He's going to sit back a little bit. He's going to snipe over our heads. The rest of us are going to run in with our, you know, plasmas and, you know, our AR or whatever.
Bolt shot.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We can say that now. We actually just introduced that recently on the Halo Bullet.
We just got out of a bolt shot playtest. It was fantastic.
Yeah. Nice.
Bolt shot's the forerunner equivalent of a human pistol that fires little bolts of hard light. And if you charge it, what are you doing with that computador?
Nothing. It just told me I needed to back up my computer.
Oh, yeah.
And
if you charge
bullshit,
you charge it kind of like a plasma pistol, but then it fires a shotgun blast.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, going back to what Chris was saying, there was a point at which I think we kind of went really wide with what we wanted to do, and we started like really exploring player choice. And Chris was really instrumental in kind of saying, okay, you know what? There needs to be some like method to the madness. There needs to be some structure here. We need to like break these things into.
I remember when we were playing with the surfboard and the Uber and the Uber jetpack on Pittsburgh.
Oh.
And I'm not going to explain what any of that means. But holy
you just
crap.
Gave me like heartburn for days.
Yes. Yeah. That was prior to me, by the way.
Yes, it's fair. It totally was.
But Chris came in. He's like, you know what? We need to break all the weapons down into classifications, and like basically you were instrumental in coming up with a method to balance everything, keep everything kind of in check, so that we could respect the core of what Halo's been from a balance standpoint, while at the same time empowering players to make those choices around play
style. And I think this is actually a good point to actually bring it back to the DMR real quick. We talked about the BR, I think, earlier this year when we reintroduced it. We talked about the fact it had some bullet spread to it at the more extreme ranges of its range. Also had a recoil, so if you're firing it too quickly, you can still control that to some extent if you're a good player and you have your sensitivity kind of peaked up a little bit. But the DMR, we decided to actually bring it back And as part of it, we actually – it still has Bloom in that it had in Halo Reach. And I'm wondering, what was the thought process of actually splitting not only the sort of the effective ranges in some ways between the DMR and BR and how fast they fire and how accurate they can be at distance, but what were some of the reasons of breaking up a one into recoil versus Bloom?
Yes. Is this a loaded question, David Ellis?
No, it is not a loaded question. I see what you mean. No pun intended.
So the reason I sort of chuckle about this is, from my perspective, I know a lot of the Halo fans aren't happy with how the reticle bloom worked in Halo Reach. And this is another topic where we had a lot of internal discussion about what's the best way to handle this stuff. Like the DMR specifically, we wanted to sort of keep the essence of what it was in Reach, but we felt like there was a better way to tune it so that it still had reticle bloom and it sort of played into the weapon role as this really, really long range rifle, but it wasn't as punishing as it was in Reach. And so in the case of that, I feel like we found this really sweet middle ground where it still uses bloom, it still comes into play on the extreme range of the weapon, but it sort of works in conjunction to make the DMR what it is and fit its role perfectly. And it's funny because I've seen discussions like when we showed the DMR off at E3, right? People were like, oh my God, they do have some weapons with bloom again. This thing's going to be terrible. But everyone we've talked to that actually plays the thing loves the implementation. It's got like just the right mix of bloom. And it's sort of.
And I think it's important to point out we've adjusted the rate of fire on the DMR.
Yeah, a little bit. The rate of fire is a bit different. I mean, this isn't the Reach DMR by any stretch. We've retuned the systems from aim assist to, across the board. We sort of started with the Reach DMR as a starting point. We started with the Halo 3 BR as a starting point. But we found that those balances didn't really work in the context of our multiplayer experience. And so they're drastically different. They sort of keep the essence of what those weapons are, but don't expect to have to wait a full second between shots on the DMR to actually be accurate. I mean, this thing is lethal from 0.3 seconds between shots.
Yeah, and that's true of across the board throughout the weapon sandbox. Like, everything has been updated to be Halo 4, right? I mean, anything
sure.
That's been brought forward has been recalibrated to make sense within the Halo 4 sandbox.
And that's actually a really good point. We actually went through a period of time where we were trying to figure out how lethal these weapons were going to be, and so I think one of the comments we've heard from people that have played Halo 4 is that actually plays faster than Halo Reach.
Deliberately, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was a period of time, though, where all the weapons were so lethal that you jump in the middle of like an encounter and
we talk everyone. We talk a lot about time to death, right? Like that's a
super important.
It's a big part of the experience. And there was a point where time to death, I mean, Chris and I was like sending Chris. I've sent Chris probably like really like annoying emails on both sides where I'm like, dude, the time to death's too slow. Like, this is ridiculous. Blah. And then I'm like, oh my God, the time to death is so quick. Like, what are you doing?
I remember that time specifically. There was a take home test where we were playing on a certain map and you just died like almost immediately.
Oh, yeah. It was like you'd spawn, die. And it's just like, okay, this is like there's no way. There was a point where it was so fast that there was really no way that you could get into a joust and then expect to retreat and replenish. You were just done. Like you might win that battle, but instantly you're going to be killed by some dude from some other angle. And that's not Halo. So, yeah, I mean, that was a.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things we struggled with was from the get-go, we sort of felt like the overall pacing of the weapons in Halo Reach were a little punishing. Like, you could come around the corner, get a jump on the guy with the assault rifle, and if the dude is better than you and he's got a DMR, he's still going to pop your shields and get a headshot on you and kill you. And so we wanted to make the weapons feel a lot more powerful. Like if you get the jump
across the board,
across the board. If you get the jump on a guy, you should have a pretty good chance of beating this guy, even if he's better than you.
Now, if he's really good, he can turn around and stick you with a plasma grenade or
absolutely.
Drop a grenade.
Yeah, I mean,
change the course of battle using other tools in the sandbox.
Absolutely, a skilled player should win those duels, right?
I mean, you watch Bravo go like whatever he went like 28-0. So clearly a skilled player can dominate.
For the record, when we were playing Halo Gaff at San Diego Comic-Con, I led our team in kills in one of those three matches. Just throwing that out there.
There was drinking involved.
Yeah.
Is there a video of this?
Yeah.
There is, actually. There is the entire thing. So one thing I actually wanted to hit back to, because I had a note of it, and I know I would get killed by the internet if I didn't ask it. The BR.
Here we go. Four shot versus five shot. Here we go.
Where are we at this point in development, and why?
No, so, I mean, this sort of goes back to what we were just talking about, right? The thing is, we started with the BR being a four-shot weapon, right? And as we started evolving all the weapons, we started pushing the boundaries of where the weapons are effective. As we started changing the spawning system in multiplayer so that you come back in the game closer to teammates than you have in the past, the pacing of the game just got so crazy and ridiculous. It was hard to counter when four of the guys on the opposing team had BRs and they could kill you in a fraction of a second, right? And so sort of the interesting thing from my perspective is I've seen a lot of discussion on the internet about why have we gimped these weapons? Why is the BR less powerful than it was traditionally? And I never hear that from anyone that plays the game because we've made so many other changes under the hood that it never really comes into play. It just feels right.
I'm curious what you mean by that under the hood. I mean, that can mean a lot of things to myself, but for people hearing that, are you talking about aim assist? Are you talking about recoil? Like, what are you talking about the under the hood stuff?
I know there's a lot of nostalgia factor behind the BR and the four shot and the rhythm and the 1.3 second time to death to kill people. And that's sort of where we started the tuning with the BR originally. And at one point in our development cycle, it felt like the right mix. We had sort of increased the lethality of all the weapons across the board. But as other systems came into play, as we developed some of the more crazy weapons, as we sort of refined and improved the respawning system and multiplayer, we found that things were a bit too crazy and over the top when it was tuned like that. So we ended up tuning it down. We sort of dialed everything across the board down. The DMR and BR both turned to five-shot weapons at that point.
I think it's important to point out that it's still actually much faster combat than people experience, per se, in Halo Reach.
I mean, you have to keep in mind that, like, everybody has sprint all the time. You know, everything, just from a general play standpoint, everything is faster. And so,
yeah.
You know, you spawn in and suddenly, you know, you're in the middle of combat and you've got guys that are able to join in to the fray and add their fire and combine fire on people, it doesn't feel slower and more methodical than in the past. And so I think, like, a lot of the tuning changes that have been made are true to the spirit of the weapon and the feel of the weapon within the context of the Halo 4 experience.
Yeah. No, I definitely would agree with that.
Yeah, I almost feel like this is sort of like the racer benchmark discussion when you see, like, a Motor Trend come out and you're like, oh my gosh, this car only has 400 horsepower. How can it possibly compete with cars that have 500 horsepower? But when you're just sort of looking at the stats on paper, it doesn't tell the whole story, right? There could be all kinds of advanced technology in this car that makes it shift faster and go around a track faster. And that's sort of how I feel about the weapons at this point, right? Like, if you just look at isolation on paper, maybe the Covenant Carbine is a tad slower than what it has been in the past, or the BR is a tad bit slower than what it has been in the past. But in isolation of our sandbox, those are sort of the right choices. And everybody that's played the game to this point, I never really hear complaints about the tuning of them.
And I think those two weapons in particular are very important to kind of point out. It's because one of the things we're actually sort of introducing for the first time in previous Halo games, when you were getting shot, you'd get knocked out of your zoom if you had a weapon that
right.
zoom. And actually in Halo 4, for the first time, you actually don't get knocked out of zoom.
That's absolutely true, yeah.
One thing you do have is your aiming reticle sort of gets knocked off target just a little bit. It depends on the weapon you're using, depends on the armor mod you're using. I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit about what was the thought process of introducing this mechanic within Halo?
Yeah, I think that's a case where when we looked at the DMR, right? Normally in Reach, when you're zoomed in and someone shoots you, it just instantly pings you out of zoom. And it's a pretty punishing mechanic. And it was a situation where we sort of assessed it and said, is there a way we can improve on this? And so one of the new things in Halo 4 is we have a flinch system so that when you're zoomed in with the DMR, it's not as punishing that it kicks you straight out of the zoom, but it'll sort of knock your camera around and make it harder to shoot a guy. And so you're still at a disadvantage if someone else gets the jump on you when you're zoomed, but you can sort of correct if the guy's across from the map and you're really, really good, the flinch system allows you to sort of reorient your aim and get the jump on that guy as well.
And I think that's a fair point as we talk about the concept of kind of a skill gap. If someone's good enough and they're able to play at a high level when their look sensitivity is set up to the maximum ability, you can actually correct for that flinch system faster than you could if you're someone who's not quite as skilled. And so the better player is still going to win in most of these situations. Not every, because even the best players make mistakes from time to time. But I think from my perspective, when I've played, that's actually been one of the things for me. I was always frustrated by being pulled out of Zoom when I'd get shot.
Well, it's incredibly jarring, right?
I felt like, exactly.
Especially if you're getting shot from multiple directions because, you know, you sort of correct for the guy that you're aware of that's maybe directly in front of you. And then you're like, okay, I'm safe. You zoom back in and you get shot from a different angle. And
the amount of flinch is dependent on the weapon you're using. So if you're using like a sniper rifle, for example, it's going to be a world of difference than if you're using a DMR, BR, or a Covenant carbine, or even the pistol for that matter.
And the amount of flinch is also about the incoming weapon by what you're hit by.
Absolutely.
So I guess we've talked about weapons a lot, but is there any weapons that you feel like we haven't talked about yet that you want to talk about?
I actually want to talk about the Forerunner weapons.
All right.
Because I think that was probably the biggest design challenge on the game, like from the standpoint of the weapon sandbox. And it's something that I know Chris put a lot of time and effort into.
And it's changed a lot.
Oh, dude, it has changed so much. Like, I mean, we started with crazy prototypes and different.
I'm
nuts
just gonna
ideas.
Say two words here that I'm not gonna say anymore. Stasis pistol.
Stasis pistol will ride again. You'll see. Oh. But yeah, there have been some, like, you know, we kind of started with this idea of we want to really push sci-fi. We want to take one of the things that is at the core of Halo, and really double down on it. And what better way to do that? But within the Forerunner sandbox. And so we actually had a ton of kind of crazy prototypes where we were trying different weapon types that were expanding the opportunities available in the sandbox and really leveraging sci-fi. But I think when Chris came in, you know, he looked at a lot of those and found flaws in some of the, you know, how they were going to work within the sandbox, but also brought a perspective of, you know, you need relatability. You need someone to be able to pick this thing up and say, okay, what does this do? When I pick it up, how do I use it? And if I don't have that instant relatability, am I actually going to keep using it and start appreciating it and enjoying it? And I think that kind of led us down a path that's been really successful with the weapons. Maybe you can talk about that, Chris.
Yeah, the Forerunners as a whole have sort of been the most challenging part of this project, right? Because the benchmark is so high for what the characters need to be, what the weapons need to be, and so we sort of killed ourselves over making sure these things are absolutely perfect. And God knows at this point how many Forerunner weapons we concepted, how many different gameplay ideas we had. We probably went three drastically different directions with them. But at the end of the day, what sort of happened was we found that the ones that were the most relatable and that people sort of understood as core weapons but sort of sci-fied up, those were the ones that spoke to everyone on the team. I think the first one that sort of caught fire was... we actually called it the spread gun at the time, but it was the Forerunner scatter shot.
Yep.
It was basically the notion of how can we make a shotgun futuristic and sci-fi and badass. So the scatter shot was sort of like we had gone down this path with a bunch of different concepts for the weapons, but that was the one that stuck, and it was sort of the one that we based the rest of the design of the Forerunner weapons off of. It started evolving into these concepts of hard light and the light panels on the side of the gun and the notion of the weapon sort of forming in the player's hand as they picked it up. And people got really excited about this. Some of the other stuff we had felt really generic at the time, but this one sort of spoke to the rest of the Forerunners as the characters came together and people enjoyed using it. And that was sort of the one that kicked off the development of all the other Forerunner weapons.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to Chris at the time because we were kind of at a crossroads with Forerunner weapons. We hadn't really made the progress that we wanted. We'd gone down all these different paths, and I was like, okay, look, just take one weapon and nail it, like just really nail it. And he started working with the modelers and the animators and the effects team and like all of those different components, audio, all of it had to come together, you know, in a chorus around this idea to really sell the vision of what a Forerunner weapon would be. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until they managed to create the scattershot and really bring it to life with all of those different components, like, you know, animating all of the formation of the weapon, having the effects that really sold the power of the weapon and set it apart from everything else, and the audio treatment for the weapon and all of the detail that was modeled into the individual components of the weapon. Once we had all of that and we could kind of look at it and go like, yeah, this rocks.
Yeah.
Then we could use that as kind of a jumping off point for the rest of the weapons across that suite.
And I think Chris's point about making it relatable and understandable to the average person when they pick it up, like in its first incarnation, the spread gun actually looked more like a crossbow than a shotgun.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Why do you hurt me, David Ellis?
No, but I think that's important to point out. It's like, I remember when the new model got in there. It's like, I had a certain feeling about the spread gun. I loved using it because at one point in its early, early incarnations, it was sort of broken because it only spread based on the distance from the player. So if you shot straight down at a player, it wouldn't spread at all, and you could headshot and kill pretty easily.
There were so many things. Like that, at one point, the spread gun would fire. It was like it would fire across the map, and it would fire in like weird patterns. And then like everyone would have a spread gun, and like it was just like a kaleidoscope game, and everyone was having like epileptic seizures on the team. And we had to rush people to hospital.
Wait a minute,
it was awful.
Crossbow.
Yeah, it looked a little like a crossbow.
It was like a futuristic metallic crossbow that fired this laser light show. And
But I will say, once the new model and the effects, I think your point about that is getting that integrated was so important, because the first time I actually remember using it with that was like, oh wait, I get this. This makes sense to me immediately. I pick up this weapon. I know how to use it. I have this inherent like institutional knowledge of playing shooters. I know how to use this weapon, and then I can learn the kind of specific idiosyncrasies of each one of them and how it works into the rest of the sandbox. I think another element that works out to that is the light rifle, and I think the people that have got a chance to see that in person will recognize that in some ways it sort of harkens back to actually Halo games of yore. There was the original battle rifle in Halo 2. Actually, when it was shown off originally,
it was fired, in the beta, right?
Yeah, it was the internal beta. For Halo 2, is it actually fired a 3-round burst when you shot it from the hip, and when you zoomed in, it shot a single shot. And that, of course, was changed between that point at when it was shown off kind of publicly at E3 and release to kind of the 3-shot no matter what you did. And so it's actually nice in some ways. The light rifle kind of sort of feels like a spiritual successor, but very alien. Don't get me wrong. It's not the Halo 2 BR. It's different. It looks and feels different, but it has its own personality that sets it apart from the DMR and the BR. And in some ways, it combines both together into one weapon.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when we first originally concepted that thing, the gameplay differentiation was, it was actually called the homing rifle, and this thing had like crazy projectiles that homed
in. I remember the homing rifle.
Was it awesome?
You basically shot one shot.
It was awesome to have.
Yeah. And it had a weird reticle. I remember that too.
Yeah.
If you could get one shot on a player, you just keep firing. Yeah, it was pretty deadly.
Yeah, it was a perfect case though where we had gotten crazy ambitious with it. And it the concept of the homing rifle probably would have worked in a single-player game, but in the context of a multiplayer game, it was just so OP.
Well, but there were two problems with it, right? Like, we kind of devised it thinking, oh, this will be awesome for players who don't really, you know, aren't really great at the game. They can take this and we'll balance it so that it's not OP versus the other weapons. But for, like, you know, a noob player, they'll be able to kind of have a general... It's kind of like the Needler, right? Like you have a general lock on an enemy and you'll be able to shoot at him. But one of the problems was, it became super OP in multiplayer. It was fun in single player to have. It was not fun in single player to have an enemy fire at you.
Yeah,
you're like,
true.
Oh, get the hell out of here. Like, why are all these things homing in on me? It had a lot of problems.
So I wanted to kind of switch gears a little bit here. We talked, I think, about the weapons, and we've talked about other things previously, the sniper rifle. Of course, we might want to hit on the sort of power weapons in a little bit, but I think the power weapons sort of hold their own sort of thing. These aren't the weapons that you're going to pick out into your base loadout. You're not going to be using the majority of the time.
But if you're lucky, you're going to pick up a binary rifle. That's what I'm going to say, because that thing is awesome.
The binary rifle is a beast, and maybe we should hit on it real quick before we sort of switch gears here. The binary rifle is a weapon that people have seen since E3. It is the Forerunner, for lack of a better term, the Forerunner sniper rifle.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the binary rifle and the role it plays in Halo 4, and maybe answer a question whether or not it is the most powerful weapon in the game, in your opinion.
Snap.
Let's get controversial here.
So the binary rifle is, without a shadow of a doubt, the most powerful sniper rifle in the game. And I will leave it at that. You can interpret that how you want. It is a one-hit kill. No matter where you shoot the guy, you shoot him in the foot. It does the Forerunner incineration effect on a guy. But it has a huge trade-off in it, which is you can't shoot from the hip. It almost has shotgun-style spread from the hip. So you have to use it zoomed. You give up situational awareness when you use it. The UNSC sniper rifle is going to be a little easier. It takes a little more skill and finesse, but it's sort of compensated on the binary rifle because you can hit the guy anywhere, right?
So how many shots do you have in the binary rifle compared to the UNSC sniper rifle?
It has a magazine size of 2, right? So you get 2 shots off, and then you have to do a reload versus the UNSC sniper rifle, which is 4.
And how many reloads do you get in the binary rifle? Testing.
Yep. The final tuning on the binary rifle, I think it's got 6 shots on it.
Okay.
You can also hear them. You can hear a binary rifle.
Just when you're zoomed in, right?
No, I mean...
You sort of have a laser that shoots out the binary rifle absolutely. When you're using it?
So, first of all, you can tell when someone's zoomed in near you. You'll see a laser effect. But also, when you're running around, you'll hear the binary rifle bark. And you know that, you know, you better use your thruster pack. You better... You better put up that shield.
Some ways it's comparable to the Spartan laser in Halo 3 and Reach, where you sort of hear the beep, beep, beep as it's getting ready to get a track on you.
Yeah, no, it's got a crazy tell. When a guy is scoped in with that thing, it turns on 4 laser sights that project across the map. So you know when someone's using it against you. So you react and you're running around.
And you give players time to sort of take advantage of, if they do have a thruster pack, being able to use it to kind of get out of dodge.
Yeah, but if you score the hit and you de-res a dude, it's
super satisfying.
It's awesome.
So good.
Yeah,
it's sweet. It's so good.
So we have other weapons elements we wanted to talk about, but I think we should switch gears now to the armor mods, which is actually something that's brand new, introduced within Halo 4. Gentlemen, I think we may have just set a record for the longest pause in between segments in podcast history.
And whose fault was that, David Oss?
how long was that pause?
It was about 2 weeks.
It felt very long.
The question is, if your computer just keeps crashing, and then you say, well, no, it's not my computer, it's the software. So your software keeps crashing. Why do you keep using the same software in the same computer and continue to lose parts of the podcasts?
I don't have a good answer.
Yeah, see? There's no answer to that.
Yeah, so we're now joining in progress the Sandbox podcast, which you have been listening to for the last hour or so. We were recording it, as Josh mentioned, and we lost the last about 30 minutes of it.
And 30 best minutes.
Absolutely. Halo gold.
But we were talking about weapons. We were talking about armor abilities. And we were just about to get into armor mods.
And what's an armor mod?
So we'll talk about that. But I did want to point out that I actually think, in hindsight, I think this delay has been good. Because we just finished the Penny Arcade Expo here in Seattle. A lot of fans have been able to play an updated build of the game, get hands-on with new weapons, new armor abilities, new mods that they've never had a chance to before. And so we definitely heard a lot of feedback from fans that had a chance to play it, and people that were watching people play it online, that sort of thing. So maybe there's a few points that we can sort of clarify on from that. But back to what we were talking about when my laptop crashed. Armor mods. So which one of the Chris's wants to hit this?
I'll step up.
What are armor mods? How do they affect my life, and why do I want to use them?
So armor mods, we have 2 sets of armor mods that players can choose via the progression system. They should both. There's interesting choices in both for all skill sets and kind of ability levels. We wanted to make sure that they're all compelling, but the first group of armor mods is called the tactical packages. Now, they affect the more of the primary systems, not entirely, but for the most part, they affect the primary systems. What weapons I spawn with, how many grenades I can carry, if I can pick up grenades, how I sprint, things like that. And then the support upgrades are the secondary and tertiary systems. How much ammo I have, how my motion tracker works, how well I can use the gun on a Warthog, for example. Now we should be very clear to you know, because I think it might be a concern for some people. Armor mods aren't this crutch that will make me outduel you in a DMR fight. Now, what it'll do is it'll make me approach the fight possibly differently, because I'll have another grenade, so I'm gonna approach the fight different. Although you're gonna have an armor mod as well, and there's an opportunity cost, of course. But mostly, you know, to circle all the way back to your question, it's these things that you earn through the progression system. It's this kind of sci-fi dream of this super soldier in the armor. It's the combination of the two and what he can do better than any other soldier. And it allows the player to make a compelling choice twice.
And you've gone out of your way to make sure those choices are as difficult as possible.
I like to have people feel a little aggrieved. I want everybody to look at their different play styles and be like, well, you know, what tactical package do I want? Do I want an extra grenade or do I want a sprint? And then, you know, hopefully they'll build loadouts around these things and take multiple loadouts, you know, maybe with the same weapon type into a game.
And those two in particular are interesting, because if you have an entire team that all takes the extra grenade and they're just spamming them, the other team all has mobility, that's going to get them extra they can do to get out of the range.
Absolutely. And then also, or they might have, you know, for example, they might have resupply, and when they're killing you, they're picking up extra grenades. So we're flattening that playing field again.
So when you're sort of, did you have any that you kind of went back and forth on which one should be in support, which one should be tactical? How much flexibility, how much movement did we have as we were putting kind of this list together?
We had a really good deal of movement. We argued about a few of them all the way up until we were pretty much locked down. For example, dexterity and the sensor mod moved back and forth, because in some ways those are primary systems, how fast I switch weapons or reload weapons and how my motion tracker works. But we went back and forth, and then, you know, we weighed them against like all the other mods. Is it compelling? Do I want an extra grenade or do I want extra sensor range? And then, you know, it comes out that, you know, especially the good players, you know, they probably want that extra grenade. So then you put the sensor mod in the secondary bucket, and then they have to choose against a whole nother set.
And some of them specifically, especially as you move into the armor mods that are unlocked during specializations, which are more kind of the end game stuff, once you've leveled all the way up to level 50 in the ranking system, you can then choose a specialization to sort of more customize your role.
You re-enlist in the specialization. You go through an additional 10 ranks of progression, and then you unlock a number of things, including a specific armor mod.
And one of those, some of those in particular, you have the Wheelman mod, and I'm trying to remember the name of the other one, that's sort of the other vehicle-based one.
It's just called Gunner.
There we go. It's not the glasses, it's the armor mod. But those in particular play really well together.
Absolutely, and they're in separate buckets for our vehicle players. So you could take Wheelman and Gunner. So when you're running at the Warthog and someone slips in front of you, you can be like, oh, it's fine, I'll shoot instead, because I have a mod for that. And they're both fantastic. Now, also, the Gunner mod helps you when you pull a mounted turret off and move through the battlefield. So it's a little bit more flexible than just the Warthog Gunner.
And that's one of those that's actually pretty useful in Spartan Ops. I can think about some levels in particular where that would – you have this big, powerful thing, but you're sort of moving sort of slow, and it's nice to actually be able to speed up, because otherwise your teammates are just going to leave you behind, and you're just sort of lumbering.
Out, like,
hey, guys, wait up. I got a turret.
Yeah, you can't sprint, but you move at full Spartan running speed. Not sprint speed, but running speed.
We've talked about this a little bit in that the armor mods, they have an effect, but they're not – They're not an overt effect. Like you said, it's not going to make you a great player.
It's not going to make you a great player. It's going to affect how you play.
So I think actually, sort of actually going to quite more of a specific direction, the shielding one, for example, which allows your shields to kind of recharge a little faster. So can you explain how that one works?
Absolutely. So
Because on paper, you see that, and it's just like,
oh, that's awesome. Oh, I want that. Right.
It's going to break the game, bro. Come on.
So the amount of idle time. So everybody knows when you get shot, your shields are set at a level, and there's a certain amount of time that has to pass before they recharge. Now, with the shielding mod, that time is exactly the same. So there's no difference in between Spartans before their shields recharge. It's very clear that that battle that everybody knows is exactly the same. Now, once their shields start recharging, a Spartan with the shielding model recharge at, I believe right now, 15% faster. Not, maybe we should.
Well, we don't have to go specifics. It's okay. Going to recharge a little bit faster. Yeah. Maybe 15%. Maybe it's 16%.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
Might be 18.
Might be 18.
It's just a little tweak.
So it's slightly faster.
Lots
but
of knobs.
We're talking about a 5-second idle time or something like that, a 2-second recharge time. And so, you know, we're talking about under a second.
And that idle time is time you're outside of combat. So if you're still engaged in combat, that it doesn't count.
It does not count. Yeah. So the shielding mod doesn't do anything for a Spartan that's in combat. And
I know initially I used to take shielding all the time thinking it worked a little bit differently. And then once I learned how it worked, I was like, oh, that's not for me. I just jump in the middle of combat, so my shields never recharge.
What's funny is it's relatively subtle, but it does save your life, or could save your life. I mean, it's not when you're looking
like
at the list, you're like, oh
like
my
a
god,
PSA like an after school special. Summer mod can save your life one day.
It could. Don't drive drunk.
Good message to everyone. Also, same should apply to podcasting as well. is there anything else we want to hit on armor mods? I mean, I think people have a pretty good list of the ones that are out there. Like the ones that I can remember people commenting on wanting to know more about for shielding, which we sort of just talked about. Are there any others that you think people might have more questions about for your armor mods? I mean, so for example, Nemesis is one that I think some folks have mentioned.
So Nemesis it's hard to tell what time frame we're in because of the podcasting time dilation. So Nemesis was being tuned right up until the last second. So it's interesting. It tells you the location of the person that last killed you, until you get a kill or they get a kill. But it's a very short amount of time that it lasts. So basically, if Death Cam is on, you've seen what happens. You know where you died. So it doesn't really help you that much. But you come into the world, you can see an icon telling you where that killing player is and which direction basically he's moving, and then it goes away. So it's relatively fast, and so it's not game breaking because if you watch the death cam, it gives you almost all that information anyway. It's just a nice reminder, and it kind of helps a little bit more in objective games, or it helps you with kind of persistent campers.
And it helps point you in the direction, but it's not something that you can use. To, like,
yeah, it's not
track
a crutch.
The player down,
and it could get you in trouble. You could go around the corner thinking there's just one person there and everyone else is standing still.
So you see that a lot. You see target fixation on the icon. People will focus on the icon and then, a ghost runs them down or something like that.
So this week at PAX, we were showing off a new multiplayer map, Exile specifically. And on that map for PAX, we had people could have a chance to check out the Banshee, the Scorpion, the Warthog, and
Gauss
the Gaussog.
I think Ghosts.
Yep, Ghosts. Yeah. Basically everything in this one map. So it was
close to everything.
A chaos.
Just not the Mantis.
Not that one in particular. Yeah. But it provided for like just crazy, crazy gameplay. Lots of explosions. Just nuts. But it's 4v4 on a fairly big level, so that actually helped balance that stuff out.
That is officially my favorite map. And that's not to say that I'm great playing on that map. I usually get destroyed on Exile, but it's everything I love about Halo.
There's a couple of like unannounced modes on in particular shine really well in that. There's one where you sort of have to be wary and be a little scared because someone could come around a corner and kill you at any point. And you
there's a mode where you have to do stuff and other stuff happens, but sometimes stuff doesn't.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's how you do it.
That's right.
That's an expertise. But Exile is a lot of fun. It's like this classic sort of in Halo in the past has had these kind of horseshoe maps, and this one just sort of takes that and dupes it. So you have this like center area, and then you have basically a ring
like
running
a big
around
donut.
It. Yeah. But whereas in some maps when you see that, for example, like in some ways Haven is sort of that. It's this ring in the center structure. But in Haven, where the center structure is wide open, you have multi-levels. The center structure in Haven, or in Exile, rather, is, you know, basically enclosed with a couple of entrances and exits.
Yeah, there's a couple of little tunnels that go through, but not directly through the center channel.
Yeah, and it's a really cool map to look at.
It's awesome.
It's just like crashed frigate in the middle of like the mountain. It just looks awesome. It's kind of fun to play on, except when we're playing against except when Josh makes us play against NeoGAF again late at night, and we get stomped.
That was unfortunate. We don't want to talk about
mistakes
that.
Were made. Let's just leave it at that. But the vehicles, it gives us a chance. We talked a little bit about it at the panel at PAX, which will be out by the time you listen to this podcast. But example, we made some changes to the Banshee this time around. I think a lot of people would agree that the Banshee was just a tad overpowered in Halo Reach, especially in multiplayer.
So Chris, why don't you tell us about what are the changes that we've made to the Banshee?
We're 15 minutes into the podcast. We were getting ready to talk about Banshees, and I realized...
Nice segue.
I'm just going to be honest.
Okay.
Chris King's mic wasn't plugged in.
Yeah.
And so he didn't say too much until this point, I don't think. Let's hope not.
Yeah. There was some making fun, and that's pretty much it. Right?
Yeah, but we were going to talk about the Banshee and the changes that were made to the Banshee.
All right, so back to serious stuff. Banshee, what do we change on it? We still want to make it pretty powerful, so it's kind of funny. We actually cranked the health up on this thing. So you're probably sitting at home listening to this, and you're like, oh, my God, the Banshee has even more health than Enreach.
Can you talk a little bit about what that means? Because the vehicle health in Halo 3 was one way, and Reach sort of changed systems a little bit. Can you talk about what we're using in Halo 4?
Yeah, totally. Okay, so the vehicle health system, we sort of have a hybrid Halo 3 Reach system. So the Halo 3 system was inheriting purely from the player. So you could shoot a Warthog, you could knock all the panels off, but if the guy drove away and recharged his own shields, the Warthog had 100% health. And so the Reach system was a little different. You could shoot components off, and it basically had buckets. And so the health would fill up to, say, 75%, but it wouldn't go back to 100%. So we sort of have a mix on the Reach system, but we've done the buckets a bit differently, and we've done how the components pop off the vehicles a bit differently. So like the Banshee, for example, I think in Reach it had 330 hit points. Ours, I want to say, is up to like 475. So it's
that's crazy.
Oh my God, I know.
What?
Can you believe this?
Overpowered.
What do you guys think? Is it overpowered? We played with it today.
I've seen no evidence of it being overpowered.
It gets destroyed.
Yeah, so like I said, everybody's probably freaking out now. Oh my God, this thing's so overpowered. But we've done a couple things to tone it down and give it bigger weaknesses this time around. So one of the big ones is the tricks it does. We've slowed those down so they're comparable more to like somewhere in between the speed of Halo 3 and Reach. So they're not as fast as Reach, and it's not as easy to evade stuff. And then the other thing is, in the maps we use the Banshee, you have all these crazy power weapons. You have guys spawning with DMRs by default. So
it's and plasma
not,
pistol.
Plasma
yeah,
pistol.
And plasma pistol. So it's not the same situation like in Reach, where one guy would get the thing and he'd be flying around for 10 minutes with it.
Yeah. I think that's fair. And once again, like, I don't know. I didn't see any evidence of it at PAX that it was dominating either. But then again, it had a Scorpion it had to contend with, which is a nice segue into talking about Scorpion.
Oh, Scorpion.
Made to that one.
Yeah. So this is one of my favorite vehicles in the game. We actually, one of the biggest changes we did, Ali Zandi, who's our vehicle designer, he was adamant about going back to the Halo 3 style steering system on it.
Mm-hmm.
The Reach Scorpion had some depth. You could pull off like the Hadoukens to make it turn around and do some crazy things. But it was also kind of frustrating at times because it wasn't responsive and wouldn't end up doing what you wanted it to do. So he actually spent a lot of time developing sort of this hybrid approach to both the systems. So it sort of works like an in-between, but you don't have the crazy Hadouken stuff anymore. So it's probably more akin to the Halo 3 system. Other changes we made to it, the speed is a bit faster now, just because our general game speed is faster.
People have sprint.
Yeah. Sprint, thruster pack, jet pack, all these things make it a little more vulnerable to getting hijacked. So we sped up the top speed and the acceleration on it a bit. And then the other big change on this one is the main cannon, the projectiles, quite a bit slower than it has been.
And it also has a little bit of ballistic drop on it.
That's right, yeah.
Further you get, so if you're shooting someone at extreme distance, you really do have to sort of adjust for that.
That's right. You can't really snipe with it like you could in Reach.
Yeah. And also,
you've improved the anti-infantry turret as well, right?
Like, yeah,
it's a little bit more effective.
All our turrets are quite a bit more powerful than in.
I actually love that. That's one of the things I love about Halo 4 is that the turrets. I felt like the turrets in Reach, I was never really super effective with them. I mean, I've got this giant Gatling gun, and I'm like laying into somebody. It just seemed like it would take forever to take them down. And in Halo 4, it like you just eat through people with the turret. Which makes it feel really powerful.
And one of my favorite turrets to use is, of course, the Warthog, the chain gun on the Warthog. And that's actually the Warthog, the handling on that feels like it's changed a lot since Halo Reach. Because Halo Reach, the Warthog had an issue where it would just flip over a lot. It was difficult to drive in some cases.
Oh, yeah.
And ours, it feels like this big, sturdy, all-terrain vehicle that wants to stay upright. It doesn't want to flip over. It will if you do crazy, if you're just crazy town flipping, driving all over the place, but it feels a lot more stable.
Yeah, to be honest, that was probably the number one issue we worked to resolve on the Warthog. We felt it was just a bit too tipsy before, and it didn't make the player feel like a badass when he hits a little rock and flips and then he has to hop out and flip the thing back over. So we tried to make it feel a little more substantial and less prone to rolling over.
Yeah, and there's also...
Same thing for the Mongoose, right?
Yeah, like, for sure.
Mongoose had the same issues in Reach, and now you can pull off some just wicked tricks with the Mongoose, like jumping over ravines
I just wish the Mongoose had something for us solo drivers, some offensive capability. I just feel a little naked out there. I just need a battle bro to hop on and go to war with me. But
yeah, now I should clarify, too, with all this stuff, that doesn't mean you can't flip the stuff over. They're still prone to getting flipped over by a frag grenade or something.
And in fact, a little bit more than even in Reach was.
Yeah, I think so. But we just tried to reduce the frequency and eliminate a lot of the annoying situations where they would flip over and you kind of felt like you were getting cheated.
Yeah, in general, if I flip a Warthog over today, it's my fault. Like, I know I did something wrong specifically. So
the other thing I'd add about the Warthog that I love this time around is the new audio we have on that thing.
Oh yeah,
it sounds mean, man. That thing cruises around and you can hear it from a distance.
I love that it sounds like this like turbo diesel just beast of burden. But fictionally, it runs on water.
It should probably be almost silent.
Yeah,
but that wouldn't be cool.
No, yeah. Exactly. In fact, there was a lot of questions because we have these kind of red cans, like decorative cans, on the back of the Warthog. They're like, oh, it runs on gas now, and if you shoot them, it'll blow it up. That's not true.
That's not true.
A, that doesn't work, and B, it's filled with water.
They're filled with water.
It runs on water. I think it's a pretty good quick hit on vehicles. I mean, Gausshog still scares the bejesus out of me.
Gausshog's awesome. I'll just like jump on the turret of the Gausshog and just sit there and like no one's driving me and I just
you're
wait.
That guy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Awesome.
Someone comes over the ridge and butchow.
Speaking of that guy, I'd like to apologize for everybody I team killed with the ghost today. I can't resist splattering people with the ghost. I don't care if they're the same color as me.
It's too much.
It's almost actually more fun because they don't move as much when you're coming out.
There's a reason for that.
It's a good bit on vehicles. One thing we'd wanted to quick hit on.
What about the Mantis?
Yeah, can we talk about the Mantis
yet? No, we can't. What we can't talk about is I think one weapon in particular that people seem to take a liking to that we talked about a little bit earlier but never really got into is the light rifle.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of people seem to enjoy using it. I heard from a lot of people in person that were playing with it, like, oh, this is so much fun. I love it. People online seeing it, thought it looked cool, figured we should talk about the light rifle.
That's interesting.
More.
So were people just picking that up and using it? Or
There was a loadout with it, I believe one of the default ones. So just a bit of clarification. Of course, our progression system, you can create your own custom loadouts. But one of the things we're doing is sort of balance out against like players who are just picking up the game and allow them to sort of experiment with things, is that we have a couple of preset loadouts per game type and map in matchmaking. So when you pick up the game on November 6th, you'll be able to experiment with some of that little later level stuff ahead of time. And if you pick it up later, like in December or January, you'll have some stuff that you can select to compete against people who have unlocked sort of everything across the board. And so we had a couple of those preset loadouts, and I think one of them had the light rifle. And it's been one of my faves for a while. We talked about the fact the light rifle, fire from the hip, 3-round burst. You fire zoomed in. It's single shot, But there are some other differences between those two modes. And can you talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, so basically for those of you that haven't tried the light rifle yet, it's basically the 4Runner semi-auto long-range rifle. So it sort of pairs up with DMR, BR, the Covenant Carbine. And the thing that makes this unique for gameplay reasons is it has two firing modes. So when you run around shooting this thing from the hip, it fires a three-round burst similar to a BR. Now, balance-wise, it's not quite as good as a BR. Like, the number of shots it takes to kill a guy is still pretty similar, but you won't be able to get as many cleanup kills as you can with, say, the BR. But then when you zoom, what happens is it goes to a more powerful firing mode. And so, basically, those three bullets combine into one super bullet. And at that point, it only takes, I think, four...
Super bullet.
Sweet. So when you do that, it's quite a bit more powerful. It's actually the most powerful rifle in the game at that point. But it's countered with a slower firing rate and some tweaks to the feel and everything else for it. And you're giving up situational awareness because you have to be zoomed in.
And, of course, the difference is if you miss one of those shots, it's 25% decrease versus if you're firing burst and you put like four or five bursts and miss one, it's not really that big a deal.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. The reason I was asking about the feedback from PAX was one of the interesting things with the 4Runner light rifle is that we didn't get the really cool sounds and effects and stuff until late, and it sort of emerged out of nowhere once we got those things. Suddenly everybody was using this thing internally.
So we recently, or not recently, over the last couple of months, we've been doing a series of playtests where we literally just pit one weapon against one weapon. No armor abilities, no mods. Try to reduce as much variables out of the equation as possible. And we had one in particular where the light rifle went against the DMR and BR. And we had some unexpected results. Like for me personally, that playtest changed my mind about the light rifle.
Really?
I've been a light rifle guy since then. It's super satisfying. And there's something about being zoomed in single shot, but then when you're firing from the hip, getting that... I said earlier that there's something psychological about that three-round burst that's just satisfying. And so when you're just sort of pinging people from mid to close range with that, but at long range, being able to zoom in and get that single shot like on the head and just boom.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of the best of both worlds, right? You have people that love the BR. You have people that love the DMR. This is kind of like the best of both worlds there. Now, it's a little slower firing zoomed than the DMR, but it's still super effective because it's got the bump and damage.
Yeah, it's not like the Covey Carbine where you can just unleash green bolts of fury at crazy speed even when you're zoomed in. But I can't really think of anything else that people have been asking about that we should talk about. I know people who are listening to the podcast at this point are
They're
yelling.
Screaming.
Can we talk
right
about
now.
The pulse grenade?
Yeah.
Have we talked about the pulse grenade?
It was there and people could play around with it.
I just don't remember what we were talking about.
We're okay
two and a half weeks
it.
Ago before you ate our lunch or whatever. So the pulse grenade is a new grenade, which is
one of your personal favorites.
It is actually. I've started building loadouts where I take the Grenadier mod so I can take two pulse grenades. Because one of the things that has been done to balance out the pulse grenade is you can only take one by default in your loadout. So you can either have two frags, two plasmas, or one pulse grenade. But if you take the Grenadier, you can have two of them. And so basically when you throw it out, well, why don't you guys describe it? Because you guys built it. I'm just describing it from like a place.
No, you were doing great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So basically you throw it out and it wherever it lands, it bumps up off the ground and then it emits like a sphere, and it does immediate damage, right? As soon as it bursts, and then it does, is it two or three?
It does constant damage and kind of builds up pressure.
And then does one final pulse.
Exactly. And that final pulse will, if people are damaged, it will incinerate them. It won't incinerate a fresh Spartan that just happens to wander by.
Right.
But again, it's the sphere. You can see the sphere. You're not going to, well, you might not wander into it. I've seen people do it. It also incinerates corpses and all sorts of other cool things. But it's definitely these three pieces. It's the initial formation of the sphere. It's constant damage, so it affects how people play.
It's like area denial, right?
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
You can throw it down.
It reminds
it's like,
me a
okay,
little bit of the fire grenade from Halo 3. That you could just sort of throw it in there and do that. But it's a little more constrained and predictable as to where it's going to do that. And it's
almost like a hybrid of that and the energy drain equipment from Halo 3.
Yeah. I know that some people have like come up with new tactics with it. Most grenades, you sort of want to bounce in front of a player and kind of send it towards them. But I've seen a lot of players just throw the pulse grenade behind the player, because the natural reaction is sort of back away.
Well, especially if you come up on someone as they're sort of their attention is, let's say, off to the side as they're dealing with another threat, or they're just cleaning up after a battle, and maybe they're a really good player, and you know, there's someone who, if you're me, you're not going to maybe be able to take down. But you throw the pulse grenade down and then start hammering them. They turn around to deal with the immediate threat, step backwards into the pulse grenade, and then get incinerated, which is really cool.
And it's really useful against vehicles.
The other big use I was going to say, especially on Exile, is when you're dealing with the Scorpion in particular, I find it super useful because you can throw it down, and the Scorpion, although it's faster, it's still a fairly slow-moving vehicle, and you can throw one, or you know, if you're lucky and you're me, you could throw down a couple of these things. And
if the person panics, like, which direction do I go fast out of the way?
Thing just rips into the Scorpion and takes it down pretty quick. So I love the pulse.
And we talked about the minary rifle earlier, so we hit into that. The incinerator. We should talk about the incinerator real quick.
We should.
Which is kind of one of my favorite weapons ever, just because it's so different in how the projectiles react after you fire them compared to.
So it's bananas in a good way, and it can be slightly fickle, but I kind of like that about it. When you fire it, it fires a slowish projectile that has these kind of sub munitions swarming around it. Yeah. It'll hit the ground and explode violently. Now we're talking about rocket launcher AOE. And rocket launcher damage. But it also sprouts out, kind of issues out these submunitions that go randomly nearby the main.
They're sort
of
physics-based and will bounce off objects.
Absolutely.
And kind of go all over the place.
I've seen people shoot it at ceilings and have the main explosions on the ceiling, and the submunitions hit the ground and incinerate people. It's fantastic and frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if you're on the receiving end.
Yeah. You can hear it coming, and it's bad news.
And Chris has sort of left out the coolest part of this gun, which is every one of those munitions plus the main shell does the incineration effect on anyone it hits.
So I did want to mention the incinerator before we cut ended this particular episode. Gentlemen, we've talked about armor abilities. I think we hit on pretty much all of them. Well, there may be some we didn't leave out. We talked about weapons. Didn't hit on every individual one, but definitely hit on like the major ones. Talked about armor mods. We talked about vehicles now, which originally we weren't going to. So,
including the Mantis.
Thank you, laptop, for crashing. This podcast is running. It's going to be a pretty.
This is the best podcast ever, despite the fact that look at all the trials and tribulations of this podcast. We've had it crash on us.
Yep.
We've taken a 2-week break. We lost Frank at some point.
Yep.
Yeah, he's gone.
Chris couldn't talk.
Nope.
For like half of this.
Absolutely. The tequila's gone.
I still haven't hit record to actually end this, so we could lose this entire segment too.
Why? No. Do it now.
All right. So I'm just going to cut this out kind of quick. As always, thanks everyone for listening to the podcast. You picked us up on Halo Waypoint. Don't forget you can subscribe via Zune or iTunes or RSS feed. Please do that. Get a chance. Allows the episodes to be automatically updated every time we release one. Please leave us feedback. If you have subscribed, feel free to hit us up on Halo Waypoint on Twitter, on Facebook. Josh, do you want people to hit you up on Twitter? I mean, you're on there, right?
Yeah, I'm at Joshington State.
Joshington State.
Yeah, I think people should on Twitter say how awesome Sandbox is.
Well, are either of you the Chris's? On Twitter,
absolutely
we don't believe,
not.
Yeah, we don't believe
in
that,
social
so.
Media.
No.
You just believe in shooting people.
Yes,
in video games.
Give it another 7 years or so.
And Frank is Frankles on Twitter. It's FRANKLEZ. Mine's easy. Just David Ellis. Feel free to leave us feedback on the podcast. Things you like, things you don't like, things you'd like to hear about in future episodes. I know as we get closer to launch, we'll be talking a little bit more about campaign. And we'll dig into some of that stuff. So until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.